Today, I had the chance to sit down with Dr. Esser, a professor and chair of the Department of Physiology and Aging at the University of Florida. Dr. Esser is also at the forefront of groundbreaking research on circadian rhythms and the impact that they have on skeletal muscle homeostasis and overall health. Her lab has pioneered critical discoveries demonstrating how the muscle clock plays a crucial role in maintaining muscle strength, metabolic flexibility, and glucose metabolism. Through her work, Dr. Esser and her team have shown that the timing of muscle contractions can uniquely influence the muscle clock, offering exciting possibilities for exercise timing as a therapeutic strategy, particularly for cases of chronic disease. Today, we spoke about some of Dr. Esser's current research on how the muscle clock adapts with aging and its contributions to age-associated changes in muscle strength and metabolism. We also explored the collaborative efforts happening in both preclinical and clinical settings to better understand the role of circadian rhythms in human health. This is one of those episodes from which I truly enjoyed recording and listening back to. I hope you can take away from it as much as I did. Enjoy listening. Erin, welcome to the Longevity Podcast. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's great to be here.
What is it that you do and why are you doing it?
I'm a professor in the Department of Physiology and Aging in the College of Medicine at University of Florida. The main focus of what I do is lead a research program and just pursuing questions about how we keep our muscles healthy and how we keep our physiology healthy, our systems healthy through lifestyle interventions like exercise.
I see. Would you mind summarizing your educational background up until this point?
Sure. I did my undergraduate studies at Wake Forest University, and I majored in both biology and math.
Biology and math.
I know. It was before. I will say I'm older, so it was before really the explosion in things like bioinformatics. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I had an opportunity to do a master's degree at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, which was really an experience of both personal and professional growth. I just moved out there to live somewhere different and such. I worked for a little while in a research lab outside of Boston, and then I decided I wanted to get a PhD, so I went to the University of Michigan and got my PhD in kinesiology there. From there, I wanted to expand my understanding of how genes are regulated, so I got moved to a postdoctoral fellowship at the Children's Medical Research Institute in Sydney, Australia. And so I couple my moves with my science, right? So that was a wonderful opportunity to be in Sydney, Australia for about 4 years and learn molecular biology, learn how to study gene regulation. And from there, then I moved to my first academic position at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
You mentioned that do your work in order to help us become more healthy. In what sense do you mean that?
There's two sides to this. One is I'm curious, right? So I think a big part of my research program is driven by the curiosity to understand how our biology works and especially within healthy conditions. So what is it that helps keep our cells and tissues healthy? So that kind of is one part of what drives me, per se. The other part is obviously I'm in a position where to keep my research program going, it has to be competitive for funding from the National Institutes of Health. And so I have to be able to relate it and make it significant for, impactful for, identifying ways to keep humans healthy and healthy longer.
Has that been a challenge?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that's when I think about mentoring students or trainees along the way, I think the one of the key parts is if you can actually marry your sort of personal, and I don't want to say selfish, but the things that really get you excited into a place where, you know, the community that has some impact on the fiscal success of your career, it agrees, right? And so I call it the kind of win
balance,
option, right?
Balance. That's very interesting because in my last episode, I featured Dr. Bragger, who focuses on chronotherapy and circadian rhythms as well. Mm-hmm. And she said something very similar. She said, it was a challenge for her to tie in what she enjoyed in life into her professional field as well.
Mm-hmm.
But she also said that was her guiding philosophy in life. And mm-hmm. she eventually ended up in the military, where she currently does mm-hmm. research work as well. Mm-hmm. She's very active, and so she has that community going for her. I think it's very interesting that you said that.
Yeah, it's the research career path is, or the academic research scientist path is challenging, right? Because our work is chronically criticized. No matter how good you are, your manuscripts, your papers, your publications, your grants, no one ever turns around and goes, oh, great job. The job of the reviewers is to find fault or find weaknesses. And so that's to balance that kind of, and I call it negative, but it's really all part of the process, is the excitement, the passion, the curiosity that, you know, and a lot of times reviewers will make a good point. And then once you get past that initial response, then like, how do you fit that in with how you're thinking? How does that open new ideas? How does that change your lens? That kind of thing.
So most of your work focuses around the circadian clock or the molecular clock.
Mm-hmm.
For those who do not know, what exactly is that?
All right. So I think most people understand what circadian rhythms are, right? Yeah. So these are, we think of it in terms of rest activity cycle, but these are 24-hour rhythms. And mostly we think of it in terms of behavioral rhythms like sleep, wake, activity, rest, feeding, fasting. But the reality is there is a mechanism inside of all of our cells that actually regulates these rhythmic patterns in our biology. And that is what, so we have circadian rhythms. And so what the circadian clock is, the molecular mechanism that is found in every single cell in our body that I call a timer. It's an approximate 24-hour timer. And its job is just to run, and it tracks time, or it manages temporal things in our cells. And so I think the other part, though, so I'm a physiologist, and I went into circadian or chronobiology early mid-career, actually. And so I didn't train in chronobiology. It was actually coming off of an experiment. But that said, what drew me into this is the idea that homeostasis in our cells, in our bodies, is not just a static point. It's actually an oscillating baseline. So different processes, whether it's protein synthesis, whether it's protein degradation, whether it's oxidative metabolism, DNA repair, all of these things have a circadian underpinning to them. And that comes from the evolution of our beings on a planet that is, you know, going around the...
So imagining homeostasis is not a static line.
Correct.
Rather, it's multiple different things oscillating.
Correct.
And if we're zooming out, it looks like a static line.
Correct.
You mentioned that every cell has a clock.
Yes.
Are you talking every type of cell in the human body? So liver cells, muscle cells, all of these cells have clocks.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will say virtually every cell. So there's some cells that may not, but in terms of when we think about all of our major cells and major tissues, yes, they all have clocks, fibroblasts, endothelial cells, so our vessels, our muscle, our heart, our kidney, our bone cells, all right, have these clocks in them, yes.
Is it possible for us as individuals to hack our clocks?
So good question. Let me see if I can think through what that would look like. So these clocks are pretty, so one of the things that's very set in the clock is what we call the period length. And that would be that approximate 24 hours, right? Now, what we do know that is absolutely hackable is the phase of that clock, right? And this is, so if I all of a sudden pick myself up and travel to France, and I'm there for a few days. So A, I'll have jet lag. What is jet lag? Jet lag is a condition in which the clocks in my body are not on the same time zone.
They're misaligned.
They're misaligned, right. And so you don't feel great. But ultimately, they align in the new time zone. So in that case, the new environment has resulted in my internal clocks shifting to approximately 6 hours. So they're still 24 hours, but their phase is different than what they were here at Florida. Okay.
Yeah.
So that part is very hackable. Okay. And that's in part why, and again, depending on who you've had other podcasts with, things like eating late at night. It's not a great idea, because what's that doing? That's telling our peripheral clocks, not so much our brain clock, that, oh, we're feeding now. That's a time cue. That's going to shift those clocks in the peripheral tissues to a different phase. But my brain clock is like still paying attention to the light. So now I can create a misalignment by staying at home. And that's what they call social jet lag. I know and there are ways actually where people in the field, this is not necessarily my research, but there are development of ways to assess human chrono misalignment. And again, the idea that this social jet lag is a contributor or modifier of chronic disease is a concept that's currently under being researched.
So based on everything that you're telling me, it seems as though there is a possibility for a perfect day if we can align everything to be in tune with our circadian clocks.
I'm always uncomfortable with perfect because it's like the opposite is never. I can't say either of those words usually. But I think the main concept here is that when we're healthy and living a fairly regular life, that our clocks are aligned, and it's then that our physiology is most healthy and most not just healthy, but resilient, which means that if I get exposed to a virus, some other stressful exposure, I can handle that stress and bounce back faster. I think a lot in terms of the chronobiology, the circadian clock stuff, it's not just health at that one moment. It's really about health of the system to be able to withstand whatever stresses come our way, which they always do. That life is notorious for that. And they can either come in the way of disease or pathogens, or they can come with other events in our lives. It's just, I think I talk to people and I say, okay, if you are, let's say, either really jet lagged or really sleep deprived, do you make your best decisions? Probably not, right? And I'm not saying all of that is circadian based, but I'd say part of that is because your system is just not in the right alignment to perform best. And this is, you can also see this with athletes, and I assume any kind of professional that has a performance aspect to it.
Yeah. And you mentioned athletes and professionals, and you're a professor, you need to perform. Mm-hmm. Athletes need to perform.
Absolutely.
Researchers need to perform. Mm-hmm. So I can't help but think that relating this to the mental aspect, if you're not in tune with your circadian clocks, mm-hmm. that can manifest in, for example, like you said, social lag and many other factors that we may not be seeing. Mm-hmm. How effective would you say is a circadian clock with our mental models or our approach to life?
I think when it comes to mental performance type things, I think there are studies that would say there are times of day that we are better, our acuity is better, our sort of sharpness, mental sharpness is better. I know, for example, for me, I'm much better reading and writing and thinking in the morning hours. And I think how much of that is because I'm rested versus just time of day. It's probably both. I'm not going to sit here and say it's everything. The circadian thing's everything. But what you'll find is, so I have a colleague that, and I have a number of colleagues that do their writing at night, right? And so I think in that regard, I'm a morning chronotype. I am absolutely that person that wakes up early and gets going. And you talk to me after 10 o'clock at night, and I can talk to you, but I'm not, that's not my sharpest. It's not my sharpest. Whereas I have colleagues, that's when they do their best work. And I don't think there's a right or wrong with any of that. But I think it's just a reflection of our genetics and our clocks to some extent.
You also mentioned you have expertise in muscles.
Mm-hmm.
How does that tie into muscle performance?
Yeah. So first off, there are clocks in muscles, and what we know right now is that there is a time of day and strength difference in humans, right? So there have been, I don't know, 20, 25 papers that have been published at least in this area where you take the same person and you measure their strength in the morning and then you measure it in the afternoon, and there's about a 10% difference in strength. So it's not huge, but it's reliable, repeatable, robust. So there's no doubt that strength is, in my mind, there's no doubt that strength overall, again, will I find a person that doesn't? Sure, you're going to find some that won't. The general population, male, female, and this is true with arm strength, grip strength, leg strength. So I don't think that there's a preference for muscle group in this either. And so obviously a lot of performance activities require strength. And so there's also some evidence that would suggest endurance is likely better in the afternoon. And there is a paper from a group in the Netherlands did some really nice work and just looked at mitochondrial function from muscle biopsies taken from muscle and these wonderfully willing participants that allowed them to biopsy their muscle every 4 hours over a 24-hour period. And when they biochemically measured the mitochondrial function, it was highest in the afternoon evening. Okay. So it's, and that would be very consistent with a improved endurance capacity in that afternoon period. And so I think that there have been some really interesting statistical analyses of, let's say, Olympic record times and time of day when those happen. And you can find those across some of the scientific literature. And generally speaking, that afternoon, early evening is a peak time for performance.
I see. So you're saying it's biochemically optimal for us to train in the afternoon.
Now, what you say, so we can train anytime. So I want to make sure, so I'm wagging my finger, but I'm not really. So I think I want to be very careful. The performance data says the performance is best there. Now, so yes, if you have the flexibility to train in the afternoon and you want to train when your body is performing best, which means you're going to probably give it a higher workload, you're going to give it a faster speed or whatever, yes, by all means. But that doesn't mean that if I train in the morning, I don't get the benefits of training, okay? So I get asked about what's the best time to train. And my overall feeling is, please just train.
Yes.
Just get some exercise. No doubt being physically active is one of the best things you can do for both your mental and physical health. But, and with a lot of people, what time they can train is not because of whether it's family or work. They don't have many options. I think it depends on the population I'm talking to.
Yes. Can that shift, though? For example, if I'm constantly waking up in the morning, because I'm a morning person as well. 5 a.m., I'm up and I'm training.
Yes, it can shift. The amount it can shift is something actually we're studying right now.
Okay.
We have done an experiment where we work with preclinical models. So these are mice. And so what we do know is if we have mice do a graded exercise test in their morning, which would be the early dark phase, versus their afternoon, the afternoon, so we can use the same mice too. So we can see that the afternoon performance is very different. Their endurance capacity in the afternoon is much greater than it is in the morning. All right. Now, if we go in and train these mice in the morning and in the afternoon, after 6 weeks of training, these morning ones have changed. Yeah, they've changed. And we've done a little bit of work. And the idea that what we think is going on is, by that training is telling your muscle clocks, look, I need you to be ready at this time. And like we were talking about with jet lag, they will phase shift the clocks in the muscle toward when you're doing the training. So the model we're working with is that it's a little more nuanced than we started with this answer. So if you are a regular trainer and you train in the morning, you should be able to recreate your best performance at that time. Yes.
Because the body is continuously adapting.
And that's part of the adaptation to the exercise getting the clocks to shift over to when that's happening.
I see. So by that logic, technically, human beings, we can adapt to any change in our environment.
Right. So at least from the clock perspective.
From the clock perspective.
The clocks, as I said, the period length won't change. But what you can do is you can shift the dial.
Phase.
You can play the phase. Yeah.
How can we apply this to chronotherapy? Is there any sort of research that's going on right now that sort of ties the clock cycle
mm-hmm.
and treatment?
Yeah, we're really starting to see some just exciting growth in this space. So let me start with one area is just time of drug delivery, mm-hmm. all right? So a lot of our drugs, and so this has been particularly put forward in the cancer space, because chemotherapies are obviously very, what you're trying to do is kill a cancer, right? So these drugs are really tough. And what they found is if, and again, some of this is in preclinical models, but it's moved into clinical trials, is trying to identify those times a day that they can treat the patient where they can minimize the dose but maintain the efficacy so the side effects are less. So that's one example of where we see chronotherapy. All right. Another one that some of your older listeners may be familiar with is the use of the drugs for statin or for cholesterol, because there are quite a few people in this country that take statins. So it turns out the liver does most of its cholesterol making while you sleep. And so the current recommendations, I'm not a physician, so I'm not seeing, but the, based on the, and so that production of cholesterol during the rest phase is part of the circadian cycle, okay? If it is generally recommended, again, to take statins before you go to bed, so that then you're working on keeping the cholesterol levels down. Again, what you benefit from that is you can probably work on a lower dose, because higher dose statins are also associated with a variety of side effects like rhabdomyolysis or a muscle sort of disorder. And so there is the theme within the chronopharmacology area is to, if we can bring timing into it, then can we work with lower doses? Because all medications have some kind of, most medications have some kind of side effect.
Yeah.
So we can still get the efficacy, but minimize the side effect. Now, the other part of this is in the field of diet and exercise, because we now know that the timing at which we eat can have the effect on clocks in our system, largely peripheral tissue clocks, not the central clock. The central clock is very tied to light exposure. For example, one of the ways we've thought about, let's say, time of exercise as a therapeutic cue is that in populations like type 2 diabetics, scientists over at the Karolinska Institute have shown that the clocks are actually damped. So the peak, so we think of these clocks where they function like an oscillator, right? So they have a peak and a trough, right? And so what happens what's been shown with these type 2 diabetics is that gets flattened. And so what we've been thinking about is using scheduled exercise to go in to help, you know, bring that amplitude.
Bring that distance up.
Yeah.
Reaching the peaks and the troughs.
Correct. And we don't know. So this is actually more of a work in progress kind of thing right now than I have an answer for that. The other one is probably much more popular, which is this new approach of time-restricted eating. And so that's become a group out at Sachin Panda and some of his colleagues have been championing this as a way to improve health by restricting the amount of time that we eat to something more like an 8 to 10 hour window. They did an earlier study just letting people eat whenever they want to, but they reported it using an app. And they found on average, Americans were eating for 14 hours. And so the idea is maybe if we bring that down and try to just eat during what I would call our regular active phase, you can call it intermittent fasting, same thing, but the time-restricted feeding just puts a time window on that, right? So that instead of, for me as a morning person, eating at midnight's probably not a good idea. And so just trying to find that window where you just say, okay, I'm not going to eat, after 7 o'clock at night or something like that, right?
Before you elaborated on the chronotherapy, you had mentioned peripheral clocks and you had mentioned central clocks.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about those two for people who may not understand?
Okay, sure. So the central, let's start with the central clock. So the term we use, central clock, refers to a particular part of the hypothalamus, which is in the brain. And it's, the acronym for it is SCN, suprachiasmatic nucleus, in the hypothalamus. And this is a structure within your brain that receives information from light cues that come in through your eye. And this is a central clock because it serves as the conductor of the orchestra of clocks in your body. And so it organizes the behavioral changes. So it will talk to other parts of the brain in terms of sleep-wake cycles, feeding behaviors, that kind of thing. It is also believed to talk to the peripheral tissues to inform them about phase, okay? And so the central clock is seen as a very dominant structure in our body, with the peripheral clocks being downstream from that. So the peripheral clocks are obviously the same clock timer, but now they're located outside of the central nervous system, now in our tissues, like our liver and muscle, heart, stomach, whatever, all right? Now, I think importantly, what we've also learned over the last 10 plus years is that these lifestyle cues, as I've been talking about, what time you eat, what time you exercise, those inform clocks in our peripheral tissues, and that can override whatever information you're getting from the central clock. So going back to this social jet lag. So even though you can be on a regular light schedule, your central clock's entrained to that light schedule. If I start having my feeding or my activity outside my normal active period, the peripheral clocks are listening to those things and they will shift.
It's like a mismatch of stimulus.
Correct. Absolutely. Yep.
So it's best if people, just for their health of themselves, if they just have both clocks in tune. So listening to both and fine-tuning that to your normal behavior habits. So eating at the right time, sleeping at the right time, exercising at the right time.
Yes. Yeah. And I always like to say, too, it's important to know that these clocks are not precision clocks. So it's not like you have 5 minutes to do this or 10 minutes. So when you talk about eating or exercising at the right time, I think of a general window of the active part of your day. So, you know, after you get up. So when I think about myself and how I apply this to my own life, as I said before, I try not to eat past, so I'm a morning person, so I try not to eat past 6 o'clock at night. Yeah. And I just am naturally morning, so I usually exercise in the morning. It's not like you say I have to exercise at 10 or at 11. I think of the day in sort of quarters, and you can take 6 hour segments.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the major misconceptions about the work that you do?
I think the idea that these clocks exist and that they regulate our physiology, our homeostasis, our resilience, I think is just new. I know I didn't get conversation about this in my physiology classes as I came through graduate school.
We don't either right now.
Yes.
And it's 2024.
Yes. And I put on my hat that is chair of the Department of Physiology and Aging here at the University of Florida, part of what we are doing is introducing some of these circadian concepts into our core principles of physiology class and what their role is in terms of homeostasis and things like that. So I think really right now is helping to share this information more widely with the public. And then within my own scientific discipline, it's just learning to talk about these things in a way that I see the clocks as a part of our cell tissue systems physiology, and it confers health and I go back to that term resilience. These clocks are what we call anticipatory. So things in your cells start changing before you wake up. Okay? Things like blood pressure, for example. Your blood pressure and your heart rate increase before you actually wake up. And there's a value to that, because if they didn't and you got up out of bed, blood flow to you going from a horizontal to a vertical position. You might get lightheaded and you might pass out, right? That's a really nice example that it's not that you're conscious and you go, okay, time to increase my blood pressure and heart rate.
Yeah.
No, that your system is doing that because it knows you are going to be waking up, okay? Or well, in that way. But that's clock driven. It's the clock is these clocks anticipate the changes that we experience over the time of the day.
That's very fascinating, because you've just shared with me the fact that every cell within our body has a clock. Mm-hmm. And that brings a level of intelligence to the most minuscule things within our body, like with our cells. Like, no one would think our cells have clocks that regulate themselves, which in part builds up to what we come to know as homeostasis. So that's very interesting and very new. It's something I've never heard before. So where do you see the future of this research and this knowledge going?
Well, that's a great question. I think just to follow, just if I could follow up on one thing, because I think when I talk to people about this, it's when what I think the clock is doing inside the cells, or what I believe the clock is doing, is it temporally distributes the jobs, right? So there are different things that have to go on in a cell over a 24-hour period. You've got to synthesize certain proteins. You've got to scan for things that are damaged. You've got to degrade those things. You may have to store substrates. So I'm thinking muscle-wise. So we tend to store things like glycogen in the afternoon sleep phase, and you have to be ready to burn those things when you wake up and you want to use your muscles. So really, in this case, what the other thing to think about with the clock is it's actually temporally distributing different jobs at different times a day, okay? And you can think about, I go to the grocery certain days to get food into my substrates, and then I have some days that the garbage man picks up the waste. I mean, it's the same kind of idea, only now you're looking at it on a cell-based scale, but you've got that temporal distribution of jobs. And that clock is an organizer too, right? And in many ways, I can imagine, you don't want to be building and taking down at the same time. That seems a little bit against the concept. And so there's that whole part of that I think is just magnificently beautiful and fascinating at the same time.
Was there ever a moment of epiphany where you're like, oh, these cells, all of them have clocks? Because this is new stuff.
Yeah. So when you say that, I think back. Okay. So when I started my lab, when I was back at the University of Illinois Chicago, my lab was studying. How does a muscle cell know it's a high force contraction and growth related pathways, so hypertrophy, versus more of an endurance stimulus, which is more a mitochondrial metabolic adaptation? So they're both contractions. How does the cell know to decide I'm going to grow versus I'm going to? Anyway, so that's the backdrop. And we did a set of experiments in which we used at that point, this is 20 years ago. So we used a first generation microarray. So we probed for genes we didn't even know about. In that experiment, these clock genes came up. And I'm looking at them, and my first response is, oops, somebody put the wrong sample. Where did this come from? But then once I got past that and it sunk in, and again, this is because of scientists are curious. So then I went and started reading. And there were some wonderful reviews that had just come out where they'd actually discovered that these clocks did exist in peripheral tissues. So that was, again, the late 1990s or early 2000s. Okay, what we're looking at is real, okay? And then there's the serendipity part. And that was, I was in the city of Chicago. The scientist that had discovered the first mammalian clock gene is Joe Takahashi. And at that time, his lab was up at Northwestern, which was just north of the city up in Evanston. And so I sent an email to him, and he could have deleted it, but he didn't. He responded, and he goes, wow, that's interesting. And so then I met up with him, and I ended up deciding to do a sabbatical and immerse myself in the circadian. But it was during that reading, as I was talking to him, it was just exactly as, oh my God. This is so cool. It was very interesting because I had a successful research program on something not at all to circadian. So I had some colleagues, when I talked to them about this, they thought I was crazy because this was a big change. Yeah. And I don't know if I'd necessarily recommend it, but I didn't feel it like I had a choice. Once I started thinking about it, I was just so fascinated and it just seemed so profound. I was like, we're going. This is where we're going. And I found the research community in the circadian field to be really welcoming. So they were fantastic. So yeah, I think, could I have talked myself out of it? I don't think I could have.
I just want to tap into that a little more. I know within academics, it can be very hard for some people to make that change, completely changing. It's still within the science field, but you're changing directions.
Yep.
Some would say almost drastically. So what advice would you have to give to people who are within the scientific space who do not necessarily feel in place or have that tendency to jump from project to project or are considering making that redirection as you did?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is very, at the end of it, I always say follow your passion, because there are challenges that come with the change, right? And some challenges I didn't even think about, but I don't think I could have changed my mind. So for example, when my lab was very well known for studying muscle hypertrophy signaling, and I had a number of, so I had some really wonderful trainees at that time. They weren't so interested in the circadian stuff. And it took a while, and I also probably, so where I ran into a challenge is attracting trainees to the lab. They didn't know what the clock thing was about. And we didn't have enough data to convince them. And then they obviously, as you say, even to this day, you don't get much training in circadian biology. And I went through a period of time that it was very difficult to recruit students, postdocs to the lab. Like I said, I had some, and they did very well, but I had to rely more on some staff people to help move some projects along. Finding your network of people, and I think I have been very fortunate. I was able to get some of the early work funded through NIH, through things like R21 mechanisms and such. And so there was, it's funny, because I just was like, here, I'm going. It's not like I had some roadmap for how this was going to work. I think you just have to, but you have to do it. No one's going to necessarily open the door for you and go, oh, that's a cool idea here. It doesn't happen that way. And could I have found ways to communicate better with environment for training? Yeah, if I could go back, I would have been more forward thinking on how I talked and promoted the work in terms of that. Yeah, so I think part of this career, like I said before, is quite hard. And so I think having those colleagues that you can talk to and you can share, and they can sit there and say, okay, Karen, I trust you and I believe in you, but I don't know exactly what you're talking about, that you can work with them to help refine your message. I think that's critical. Communicating our science is so important.
I think it's very important, as you say, to just, if you have that inclination, just do it. Mm-hmm. Just doing the work, because no one else.
As a scientist, probably this is true across all professions, but your work product is what reflects you. Just because you tried hard doesn't matter. It does matter at some level. I'm not saying that, but when you're talking about recognition from peers, from funding agencies, from leadership teams, they're going to look for the product. And for me, it's papers, grants, and helping train the next generation of scientists. Yeah. And so there has to be that product. You always have to think about that. And sometimes I don't want to, because I actually like writing grants more than I like papers, because it's like I already know the paper. But you've got to get that out. You've got to get that out to your scientific public. And again, I really appreciate the podcast opportunity, because I think as scientists, we need to do better at communicating what we know to a broader audience.
Are there any aspects of your work that you wished we had talked about that we haven't?
I don't think so. So we've talked about the exercise. The other part is we are starting to look at this in an aging population. And I think obviously there are a lot of things. Aging is a very complex situation, and you have a lot of factors in terms of DNA stability, DNA repair, and a number of metabolic things that are going on. Where we are coming at it is the idea that the just like lots of processes, the clock process doesn't work as well as we get older. And that's been shown by a number of groups. So anybody that does any traveling, as you get older, that adjustment takes a little bit longer and is a little harder. And we've done some work to identify that the transcriptional output of the clock in these different tissues is absolutely changing. Even at middle age, it's starting to change. And so the goal with this is to, going back to you hijacking the clock, is to find ways that we can go in and try to help boost the clock function as we get older. Try to understand why does the clock not, it's still running, but it just does. It's like some of the gears are missing. It's just not doing this exact all the same functions it was doing before, at a younger age.
It's almost exhausted in a sense.
Yeah. And it gets progressively worse, right?
The older you get.
Yes. And I think I always try to be very clear that my goal is not to necessarily. I'm not working to make us live longer. my main focus is right now, because other people are doing that. But I'm very interested in trying to help us be as healthy as possible for as long as possible.
I see. That's funny. The name of the podcast is the longevity
podcast. Yes, I know. I'm just like, maybe not so much longevity. Health span, though, definitely. Yes, definitely.
I think that's very important as well. And I think there are many people I talk to who are on the older side, and they tell me about how much their lives have changed the older they've gotten. They can't do the same things as they used to when they were 21. They can't lift as much. They can't run as fast. They can't think as clearly. But I think the older we get a different appreciation for life. And I think that sort of...
There's a balance.
Being young, I've started appreciating the fact that I can do all these things now. What is the one piece of advice that you would give to the aging population on how they can better handle themselves and in part handle their clocks?
Yeah, I think it's, like I said, it's what I do myself. And I'm an aging individual. So I think thinking about taking care of your sleep, sleep habits are important, including activity in your day, thinking about your timing of when you eat. I think one has to be really careful, especially with aging. I don't want to get into sort of things that will cause weight loss, because a lot of people struggle with maintaining lean mass as they get older. So please eat. But I talk to my friends about making sure they try to keep their rooms dark at night. We've got lots of electronic devices, and a lot of people, they may say, oh, I don't have a light on. But you turn the light off and you can see all the lights from all the different devices around the room. So consider how dark your room is and trying to minimize the light at night kind of exposure. And so that's my general theme for this right now that I would say is, and I think the activity is actually going to be very important.
Just constantly stay in motion.
But
decreasing the older you get.
Yeah. So it's there's no doubt that we can adapt as we get older. Even if you haven't exercised your whole life, you can get benefits from exercise as an older person, okay? So that's absolutely true. And so I think, and so finding ways that you enjoy being active is important. And when it can be, it doesn't have to be the 10-kilometer race or the lifting competition. It's just move. Yeah.
Just do it, as you said.
To borrow from Nike.
Yep. A last question I always ask every single one of my guests is, what is one message that you want to share with the world?
I think I flip-flop between the scientific message versus just hopefully, I guess what I always want for people is to find something that they can be proud of in what they do and think about what you're contributing to the world, to your neighborhood, to your family, and be proud of it and do it. That sort of, I mean, it's, yeah, because we all count. And I think sometimes we forget that. And remember that you have clocks on all your cells.
The main takeaway of the episode.
These are real. They exist. And I'd like to think they'd be part of our academic teaching mission in the next 10 years.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. I thank you very much for taking the time to sit with me today. I had a great time.
Thanks, Macaulay. I've really enjoyed it too.